Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 12 of Peach State Prospects, your go-to podcast for all things Atlanta Braves minor league baseball. Joining me today is my co-host, Garrett Spain. Garrett, how are you doing today?
I am doing all right. Excited to get into draft season. How are you?
I'm doing well. Did you get a chance to see any of the game one of the Braves doubleheader today?
Me? No, I was at work all day, so no games for me.
You're missing Austin Riley just going absolutely nuclear, so that's making me very happy. Joining us today is longtime friend now, my word, Matt Powers joins us from Battery Powered, and it's been a couple of years. Matt, how are you doing today?
Pretty good. I mean, it's draft season, so it's the most exciting time of the baseball season for me, at least.
My favorite memory of Matt is when he had, I think it was like a top 400 for like his own personal top 400 rankings for one draft. And he was on an Apple note on his phone. He just sat there and recorded for like 400 different names and ranked them. That's when I knew Matt was like half psycho. And I was like, okay, I gotta get to know this man better.
It's just easier to keep everything on the phone because you could always edit it anytime you're at a game and don't have to bring the computer or anything with you.
Fair enough. So today's episode, like Garrett said, is as we're heading towards draft season, it's going to be heavily draft centric. And when you have a frankly draft genius with you, you ask him as many questions as you can. So this episode is going to be mainly centered around Matt Powers and everything he knows about the MLB draft. It's going to be one heck of an episode, I got a feeling. So let's go ahead and get started. Matt, just overall, I want to know your overall thoughts on this year's draft.
Well, I mean, overall, it's pretty safe to say it's not my favorite draft, that's for sure. That's not to say it's bad. It's just I don't really love the first round, especially from the middle down. And that's really, I think it's got some impact to it, but not so much in that first round. The fact it's so weak on the high school side is really the biggest thing for me, at least in terms of the first round. That's what kind of brings it down because it kind of removes some of those upside guys, even though they do come with a little bit more risk. I mean, don't get me wrong. I still think it's possible to have a good draft and get some good high schoolers, but they're going to typically come with a little bit more questions than they would in a normal standard year.
So, I mean, you say that it's, you know, a particularly weak draft in terms of high school guys. Is that kind of the standout for you? You know, how does this draft compare to, you know, previous years in terms of the talent and the depth of it overall?
Well, the college bats are very strong to me. Six of the top eight guys for me in this draft are college bats. College arms are a little bit down, although at the top there is, of course, Burns, Higgins, Smith, Savage as true first-round college arms, but there aren't really as many true first-round college arms as you'd see in a normal year. There's a couple prep bats in the top 10, but it's really a very, very light first-round year for them other than Griffin and Rainier. The prep arms class, it's not great. It's just okay to me. Probably a little light after the top couple guys that are going to go in the first round in terms of that higher round status that you'd see in a normal year. So I think that's kind of where this draft is a little weaker to me. But, I mean, there are still some pretty good players that I do like in this draft.
Just like initially, you made the comment about how the overall, like, lack of standout prep bats is there. Do you think some of it has to do with, you know, the NIL and in college and these high school, like the top prep talent being heavily tied to a school and generating, getting some money from there? Or is it just this class overall at a prep side is just very.
Yeah, I don't think it's related to the NIL. I mean, the NIL would really only come in where it would push a guy to college, where at least those top first round guys, those guys aren't really going to be as influenced by potential NIL money as compared to the big money from the MLB teams and getting their career started sooner, at least for the most part. It's more that second tier and lower of player that wouldn't come into play. So I think it's more just this year's class more than anything.
Yeah, very interesting note. So, you know, just a few years ago, Major League Baseball brought on this new initiative, and they started a very elaborate draft combine. That just happened a few days ago. Were there any players that really stuck up, that really improved their status from going to this combine?
A little bit of both. I think there were some definite risers in this combine from the hitter side, from the college bats. Joseph Sullivan from South Alabama showed off a lot of power, more power than we had actually expected from him. And he had some of the hardest hit balls of the entire combine. He was really the one college hitter that stuck out as a riser to me there. On the prep side, Tyler Bell, Illinois high school shortstop, which hitter was hitting the ball very well from both sides and also had a very strong infield session. I think he improved his stock. Pennsylvania kid, Chase Harlan, a third baseman, had another strong batting practice and opened some eyes. While on the pitching side, a guy like Dennis Cullerand from Northeastern, who hit 100 multiple times in games this year, but really struggled with his command and posted some ugly numbers on the year, had the three fastest pitches on day two, and also his fourth, fifth, and sixth fastest tied for fifth place as well. And he also showed something with the cutter. So a guy like that, who really had a down year numbers wise, performance wise, kind of helped his stock a little bit. I mean, he's been on the radar forever, but the stuff just showed that it played. California high school right-hander Cade Townsend hit 96.6 with the fastball, and the spin rates really, really opened some eyes. He had the number 1, 2, 4, 5, 7, and ninth best spin rates on his day in the
Jeez.
combine. I mean, how do you do much better than that as a high school arm in the combine setting? And then Iowa reliever Cade Obermuller, son of a former big leaguer, showed off some big spin too with a couple sliders that were over 3,000 RPM and a third one that was at 2,900, along with some spin on the fastball. But those guys really were the guys that really stood out to me at the combine.
You really know yourself, Matt.
Yeah, I'm over here. He's listing out names. I'm like, I don't even know who this person is. And I mean, are there any, what are some under the radar kind of pop-up prospects for you that you think could really be a surprise or a good pick for the Braves in this draft?
I'm going to save one of them because he, well, two of them really, because they have come up as guys that are linked to the Braves already. So I'm going to just focus in on one, the rare Idaho right-handed pitcher, Dax Whitney, a kid that saw a velocity jump this year up to 96. He's got two different breaking balls that could become potential swing and miss pitches, throws a change, which could become an average pitch for him as well. Throw strikes, projectable arm, 6'5". I mean, a kid like that who was in the low 90s at the start of the spring, well, last in the start of the spring, in the fall, really raised his stock this year. And to do it out of Idaho, which is not a state that produces much big league talent, I mean, that's a guy with the kind of arsenal that you want to bring in, and that cold weather arm who also brings projection. There's a lot to work with in a guy like that.
That's an intriguing talent. A cold weather arm that throws 96 already. Do you foresee ability to even improve that velocity, or are you thinking more along the lines of his secondaries is where he can do the majority of his work?
I think that he could do a little bit of both. I think that he could potentially have three plus pitches. Fastball probably isn't going to improve a ton velocity wise, but I think it could tick up a little bit more, maybe up to that 97, 98, 99 range, because he definitely has a lot of room to pack on some weight.
That is an intriguing profile from that. So this next question, I want to ask the both of you, and Garrett, I want to start with you. How do high school prospects typically compare to college prospects in terms of their readiness and overall potential?
The general idea is that, if you're looking at overall future high-level potential, you want to target these prep guys because the better guys tend to go in the right out of high school straight into the professional ranks. And the Braves tend to target a lot of college prospects just because of that readiness you talk about, where a lot of these college guys, they're a year, 2 years away from the major leagues, and a team like the Braves are really looking to kind of push guys up quickly. And then, they typically will target those, higher ceiling, riskier types in the international classes.
Matt, What do you have to say about that?
I mean, I pretty much agree with that. The prep guys, they're always going to need that more time to be ready. They do also typically come with more upside, at least the higher end guys that you're thinking of in the first round, but they also come with that much more risk. But in addition, they just take that much longer because they're that many years behind, just in terms of physical development and additional years of higher level coaching that the college guys have had.
Yeah, they definitely come a lot more prepared out of college. And then it tends to also, that college route tends to also weed out some arm injuries. Unfortunately for the Braves, you have someone, a draft where you get, Owen Murphy, J.R. Ritchie, Cole Phillips, and, all three of them are sitting out significant time with Tommy John. Because, this is a hard transition from throwing a very limited amount of innings in high school to then trying to get to 100 and then 100 plus. So there's tons of risk, I feel like, in high school and prep prospects that college may not have as much, just because when you have those injuries again over time, it just unfortunately weeds out some players.
So the next question we wanted to get into is talking to you when you're evaluating a guy, how important is it when you look at a guy's performances, in the showcases and in tournaments against top talent compared to how they do just during the regular season?
Oh, it's a very important thing, but obviously not the only thing. Those tournaments and showcases are looks at them facing top competition. Not that the regular season is meaningless, but facing guys who are going to get drafted on day one or two is significantly more value than facing some guy who isn't going to project as going pro or isn't going to project is going to college, depending on if we're talking high school or college player, as it's just a bigger test of how they might be able to do against handling pro ball. I mean, facing as a hitter, facing a guy that's going to throw 90 plus versus facing a guy that's going to throw high 70s to low 80s, there's really not much that it shows you to face the guy that's not going to be able to throw stuff that you're going to see even in the lowest levels of the minor leagues. So that those are important, but they do still have to stand out when they're facing those lesser talents as well.
And then how do teams go about approaching, those high school guys and drafting guys with signability concerns, such as those that are really committed to playing college baseball?
I think it's all teams just they know they have this certain amount to spend on their draft before they're penalized with a future pick. So they just go ahead and they reach out to everyone that they're interested in and get what the bonus demands are. And then they just weigh what the potential reward is for that player, what they think he can be. And they measure that against what they think they can get out of a lesser player. I mean, let's say a $2 million center fielder out of the high school ranks versus a $1 million center fielder from the college ranks. That $2 million high schooler has significantly more potential, probably a little bit more risk too, but that $1 million in savings that you're taking, that college player can be spent on $1 million on multiple other players in different ways and give you more shots at the apple. And since there's already going to be a high failure rate for the draft. I mean, look at draft classes year to year from team to team across the board, and there's going to be significant numbers of failures throughout. So it sometimes it's more about just taking more chances to hit on one or two of those players. Sometimes it's about, okay, this guy's actually worth taking that risk and throwing all of our eggs in one basket type of situation. And I think that's where the front offices have to debate with themselves on what each player is actually worth to them based on their bonus pool available.
I would just absolutely love to be or even have access to some of these proprietary metrics that I'm sure each MLB team has in grading these specific prospects for the draft. I'm sure it's a complete science behind it and they, eliminate as much risk as they can. I'm sure it's absolutely fascinating and one day we'll get access to that and see how they do it. All right, thanks for that, Matt. Moving on. This question again, I'm going to go to you first, Garrett. When it comes to the Braves, how do you feel like they balance the need for immediate help versus gambling on that long-term potential when they're making those picks?
Typically, what we've seen from them now that they're kind of competing consistently is they're at the top of the draft looking through for safer picks if they can get to the major leagues, and specifically pitchers that they can get to the major leagues quickly. I don't, I think some of that is a case of you're picking in the back of the draft, and that's just what's been there for them. They haven't necessarily had the ability to target high-end prep guys because those guys haven't slid to them. And so, based on where they are and where they pick, it's been easier for them to get those kind of short-term gains out of the top of the draft. And then they, like Matt was talking about spreading out money, they've gone and gotten guys like AJ Smith-Shawver, guys like Isaiah Drake later in the draft that they can feel can help them long-term without necessarily spending a major draft pick.
Matt, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much what I see. I do think the Braves are open to taking those guys that might be a little further away if they think they could help. They haven't really had the chance to grab those high-profile prep guys with big upside because of where they're picking in the draft. And they're either at the point where they're already off the board, or teams with a bigger bonus pool are able to offer more money to buy them down than the Braves can afford or are willing to be able to afford, because that would mean basically punting most of the rest of the draft to draft that one player. And one player is not going to make a draft in many cases. I mean, we've seen it once in recent memory with the Braves, and that was two players, the Kyle Wright, Drew Waters draft. But I think it just kind of plays into, we don't have a ton of money. We're picking late. We're just going to maximize what we're able to get with as many shots as we can at picking a good player or multiple in the draft. And that's kind of what they do.
Great insight from the two of you, and kind of building off of that question, Garrett, hear from you first. How significant is the role of a player's, overall character and off-field behavior in the draft evaluation process? What have you seen from the Braves?
In recent years, the Braves have really placed a lot of emphasis on a guy's makeup when drafting players. And that's one of the first things you hear about the Braves is they'll come out and say, we really like this guy from a personality standpoint, from how they work, from how they carry themselves on the field. And, I don't know that that was necessarily something under Frank Wren, under John Coppola, that they really focused on as much. It was just go out, get the absolute best talent you can find in a lot of cases, or the guy that they thought was best. Whereas I think, under Alex Anthopoulos, they've really shifted towards really throughout the draft, 1 through 20, getting guys that fit with the culture of the organization and with what they're trying to do. And you really see it top to bottom that the Braves have one of the better cultures in all of baseball.
Matt, do you feel like this is kind of consistent throughout the league, or is it more of a Braves-centric philosophy?
I definitely think it's more Braves-centric. I do think other teams do put some emphasis on it, but I think it varies team to team. I think when you're picking at the top of the draft, I think that matters a little bit less sometimes because you want to bring in the best possible player that you can, and that's all you're looking for. Because if you don't have good players, it doesn't really matter what the culture is like for the team, because you're still not going to be able to win. So I think it kind of balances out there a little bit. But when you're a good organization like the Braves, top to bottom, I mean, bringing in good character guys that are going to fit in well in the potential clubhouse, should they make it, does play a factor. And it varies by team, even among the contending teams.
One thing that does come to mind with this philosophy is what just when talking with Chris Harris a couple of weeks ago, over in Mississippi, you had Ian Mejia, Hurston Waldrop, and Spencer Schwalenbach all in the rotation at the same time. And they were all there to push one another, to learn from one another. And that comes, a lot from those high character, people that you can really trust and believe in. So there are serious pros by going with that philosophy. So moving off from there, Garrett, I'm going to go to you here first. We've seen, the two traditional schools of scouting. There's like that heavy analytical approach, and then there's the people that are like, no, I got to trust my eyes, and the more traditional scouting. It seems like we are driving, heading more and more towards analytics having a heavy role. But I want to hear from you. What have you noticed about the Braves and the role that advanced analytics play in their overall evaluation of prospects?
Specifically, with amateur prospects, they're nearly entirely driven by their models. Their first round pick, there tends to be a little bit more discussion with scouts and stuff like that. But really, beyond the first round, first couple, most of those picks are, scout identifies the talent and they kind of see where the models take them. And the Braves almost draft completely off of their models. And, we'll kind of, it's going to take a long time before we really see the effects of that and how that's going to play out. But that's really how they've gone to in the last few years.
Matt, is that, do you, is that trend kind of universally accepted across baseball, or is this more of a, a Braves approach?
I think it's more of a Braves specific approach. I think other teams do it, but I think it really just varies team to team. I mean, different teams just put different emphasis on analytics, just like any other tool or that they're able to use to evaluate a player. I think the Braves right now, especially last year, are doing it at a significantly higher level than most, though.
Interesting to hear. Now, Garrett, next question. I'm going to go to you first as well. In terms of the Braves, what are some common, mistakes that you've seen them take through their own ongoing philosophy? Is there anything that really stands out or any trends that you've noticed over the last few years?
I think that they've gotten somewhat better, but over the last few years, but there was for a while there a lot of them trusting, kind of wanting their guy and not necessarily moving off of that all that much. Now I think that over the last few years that they've been a little bit more, they're kind of just open to whoever falls down to them, especially when you're looking at the first round. And in my opinion, they can be a little bit too pitcher heavy just because of the risk. Naturally, pitchers have a lot more risk in the draft, and the Braves tend to be very pitcher heavy to the extent, like we've seen with that 2022 draft, where a vast majority of that draft has been hurt. And I think that that's kind of, I would say, the worst thing that they're doing, possibly the worst thing that they're doing, is that they're very pitcher heavy. I would like to see somewhat more of a balance, but I do think that, overall, kind of how the drafts have shaped up, I kind of understand it at least.
Matt, you and I have had this conversation what seems like 50 times, maybe like at least twice a year. What are some pitfalls that you see from the Braves drafting philosophy?
I do think they're a bit heavy on pitcher. I mean, not significantly, but a little too much. I think they could be more open to hitters. I do think they could be more open to prep guys in those early picks than they have been. Not necessarily take the prep guy, but it just seems like it's a clear preference to go with college arm versus best player available. And that can be frustrating at times because it kind of limits your options a little bit. I also think that they do put maybe a little too much emphasis on some of the analytics. I mean, I'm not saying that putting an emphasis on the analytics is a bad thing, but I do think there is a point where maybe there's a little too much on that, and maybe they do need to get back a little bit more to trusting the eye as well, while also focusing heavily on the analytics. And I do wonder just what the percentages of analytics to the eye test are there right now, because I think going heavy on whether it's just the eye test, just the analytics, going that heavy on just one thing, I just don't think is a recipe for success long term with one strategy.
I actually want to bring up kind of an extension to that question. Would you, what are kind of your thoughts on, the Braves almost always go under slot in the first round. Do you think that that's kind of a valid strategy for where they're picking, or do you think that that could, they should be maybe more, a little bit more open to going in on specific players?
Think it really depends on what's even available. I have heard some things where in the last couple of years, the Braves were actually in on some higher upside players with their first round pick, and they probably would have cost quite a bit more money. But those players came off the board slightly before the Braves were actually up, so they never actually got the chance to do that. So I think what's on the board at the time does have some influence because the Braves are playing with a small bonus pool compared to most teams by picking later in the first round. So they're trying to extend that small bonus pool as much as possible because maybe they just don't love what's available in the first round. They might like the pitcher or player, but maybe they're not absolutely in love with that player, so they just want to save a little bit of money and be able to take another bite somewhere else.
Another quick follow-up to these misconceptions or mistakes. What are your thoughts on that 2020 Angels draft class where they selected a pitcher with all 20 picks? It was like the weirdest thing. I just randomly thought of it. What are your thoughts on
I honestly don't even know how to feel about that. That it's just
that?
something that will never happen again and probably never should have happened. But yeah, my God, that was just such a weird draft, and I could not believe that it actually happened. But they did that, and here we are. It would be very interesting to see how that ends up playing out for them long term. It's still a little early for that at this point, but it's definitely going to be something that I'm watching. At this point, we've seen two big leaguers so far, and one of them has actually appeared in any real number of games. The other one has pitched in something like 10 or 11 games, and none of them this year. That would be their first round pick that year, Bachman. But Silseth has really been the only pitcher so far that's actually pitched any significant time in the big leagues yet. Considering all but one were high, college, only one was high school, that's not a very good sign for how that draft's going to work out long term. But I mean, it is still a little early to make that final call.
Don't know, man. If 19 of 20 were from college, that means you probably pick them because you want them to, progress relatively quickly. So that's not too great to hear. Thanks for that detour, Matt. Moving on from there, we talked about what we feel are the mistakes in the Braves strategy. Now I want to hear from you, Garrett. How do you feel about that approach overall? We talked about the concerns, but how do you feel about the job the Braves have done in drafting over the oh, let's just talk about the recent future under Alex Anthopoulos.
I've definitely had some. I mean, there have been questionable picks for me. Like the Drew Hackenberg pick last year didn't make any sense, really still doesn't to me, but I do understand their process. And the one thing that I do like about their picks is they get these guys into pro ball and they know exactly what they're doing with them, whether it's making changes or in the case of guys like Waldrop, Smith-Shawver, if the guy comes in and he does well, they're not drafting for 5 years from now. If the guy is good enough, they're going to get him to the major leagues as soon as he's good enough. And so, because they're going so college heavy, the fact that they're willing to push these guys quickly and not be really afraid of service time and not be worried about necessarily hitting every single developmental milestone along the way, you do have to like that they trust themselves and what they're doing and they trust their process. And while I agree they're a little bit pitcher heavy, especially early in the draft, I do think that, especially in the first round, a lot of times that's just how it shakes out. And overall, I have the guys that they've gotten in on the prep side, I tend to like. So overall, I haven't had too terribly many issues, though I do think that sometimes at the top of the draft, those college pitchers aren't necessarily the guys that I would have gone to with those picks.
Matt, let's hear from you.
Well, I mean, it's kind of tough to evaluate because we've seen some changes and differences in these last couple drafts. I mean, the 2019 draft was a draft that I loved despite really not liking the day one picks at all, because it was filled with those overslot guys. And we've already seen some dividends pay off from that between guys like Michael Harris and guys like Grissom and Langeliers, who were traded for other contributors. 2020 was just simply weird all around because of the short draft and the less time to actually scout those players. But they hit on two all-stars among their four picks that year. So, I mean, strong draft. 2021, I really did not like the top pick at all. Getting Schwellenbach in the second was great, even though didn't love him in the first round, but I did like him a lot in the second. Then they turned Justin Henry-Molloy into an asset. AJ Smith-Shawver is looking like a steal in the seventh. Again, more overslot guys. Things changed in a major way in 2022, where they went with prep arms early, and all four of their top picks in the 2022 draft have undergone Tommy John surgery, though one of them was obviously before he actually did get drafted. So it's really hard to evaluate much with that draft, with all that missing time. But clearly, Nacho was the real steal in that draft. And then 2023 is another class where it's tough to really evaluate much because obviously a new guy making the calls with Dana moving on. And I wasn't really in love with that class. Obviously, the Hackenberg pick and giving him $2 million. I don't really understand it at the time, don't at this point, and I don't think I ever will. But we're less than a year out from there, so you can't really evaluate that class well.
No, totally fair, and I think we're all aligned with the Hackenberg pick. Like, I remember just thinking, okay, that's interesting. And then when the signing bonus came out and they paid him $2 million, it was a bit of a shock, to say the least.
You know, Braves fans, a lot of them are from the Atlanta area. They tend to like, you know, the Georgia players. And are there any kind of local high school or college guys that you think the Braves could consider either in the first round or in those later rounds?
Not first round for sure. There's really only one local player worthy of a first this year, and he's not going to be there when the Braves pick. I have him as my number one player, Condon from Georgia. Beyond that, there's quite a few. One of them that I think really fits well with the Braves is Conrad Kaysen, right-handed pitcher out of Greater Atlanta Christian. So he's a young for the class, two-way star. So young for the class really sticks out for the Braves. Those two-way guys sticks out for the Braves among prep players, but he already touches 98 with the fastball and has a change that's a weapon as a high schooler, and obviously a ton of room still to grow into his pitching ability. From Snellville, Brookwood, there's three pitchers that have really gained interest. I especially like Jackson Barbary and Charlie Foster. Jay Abernathy from North Cobb High School had a good combine. He's not big, he's not overly toolsy, but he performs well, makes good contact, strong defender. Might have a bit of a price tag attached to him as a Tennessee commit. Then there's Terrence Kyle II from Pace Academy, son of the former NFL player with the same name, who's really risen this spring and also a two-sport star himself. The money is right. He could be a fun pick with some crazy athleticism, but he's raw as a hitter, very raw as a hitter, even though he's made significant progress this spring. But he could be expensive to get away from Texas A&M, although with the coaching change going on there, you never know. But obviously,
Oh
we're in the
man.
NIL days at this point, so it's hard to really say. And then Corey Collins, Condon's teammate at UGA, is a senior, but he won't be a typical senior sign, but he's got big raw power. And there's some questions about his defense and hit tool, although he has made some progress with the hit tool. But he's definitely a guy I'd watch, especially if he can come at some discount for being a senior.
Here I was expecting like two or three, and then we get like full scouting reports of half the players graduating. Incredible insight. Thank you for that, Matt. So taking it one step further from there, Garrett, I want to hear from you first. Are there any specific prospects that you hope the Braves will select?
There's really one guy that I've kind of liked a lot since he was mocked to the Braves a lot earlier in the process. Carson Benjy, Oklahoma State. I don't think that he's going to be there at 24. At least it kind of seems like he's not going to be there at 24. But you know, surprises happen. I don't think anybody expected Hurston Waldrop to be where he was last year as well. Benjy's a really high-level athlete, a guy that the Braves would like in terms of that profile. He's really hit well at Oklahoma State this year. Had a really great spring. So he's really the guy that kind of early in the draft process has stood out, but I'm sure Matt has a much longer list of names that he would like.
Yeah, man, let's hear from you.
You're right about that, and Benji's also on my list. But I will say, more than ever, I don't really have a specific player that I'd want to target as much as one of a group of guys. In addition to Benji, one of the Tennessee Bats, Moore or Amick. Malcolm Moore, the catcher, is a player I've liked a lot since high school. Other bats like Waldschmidt and Jordan, kid like Brecht, the pitcher from Iowa. And then I also wouldn't mind going underslot and taking a kid like Doughty, who we'll get into a little bit more later because he's already been linked to the Braves a little bit. But taking that underslot guy and saving some money for some of the future picks in this draft, spreading that money around, because there isn't necessarily that one guy that at this time I see being there that I would just say they have to take this guy because he's just so good and you can't pass him up, as much as just a good player.
You haven't missed a beat. Like, you just had the perfect segue for me without really, I don't know if you knew that you were doing that, but kind of building off of this, off of that question, we wanted to talk about some of these players that have been that have been mocked to the Braves. And first, I want to go with a player that has been there a lot more recently, and that's Ryan Waldschmidt. Garrett, I want to hear from you first. What are your overall thoughts on Ryan as a prospect and his fit for the Braves?
I think that we both kind of talked ourselves into Waldschmidt, which means that more than likely, Braves aren't going to take him, because that's how it always goes. We really like a guy, and then suddenly he's not there at 24, or they pass on him. But Waldschmidt's a guy that, you know, one of the main connections with him is the underlying data for him is very good. And, you know, we talked about it earlier. The Braves are very data heavy in terms of their evaluation. You know, I think the biggest question with Waldschmidt is where he's going to end up long-term defensively. It kind of seems like he does have – it seems like most people see him as a left fielder. I think if the Braves were to take him here, because they tend to, in the first round, go after – when it's position players, they're going after guys that they think can play premium positions. I think if the Braves were to take him, they would probably run him out in center field until he absolutely proves he can't. And I think they tend to trust their ability to develop guys defensively in center field. You look really – top to bottom, they've got a ton of guys, Michael Harris second, Kevin Kilpatrick, guys that are very good defensive players that maybe, well, Kilpatrick probably was, but Harris was a guy that no one really thought was going to stick in center field long term. So I think that they trust their ability to develop guys defensively. And Waldschmidt, the offensive talent is through the roof there. And if they can get him there and feel like he can stick in center field, I think that would be a huge steal for them at that point.
Matt, same question for you. What are your thoughts on Ryan?
I mean, he's a different situation all around. The injuries have defined his career dating back to high school. Well, injuries and COVID. So missed time has been a real thing for him. So that kind of explains why he's only been a more recent riser, helium guy this year. But the bat is there. I think he's going to hit for both average and power, and he's got above average speed. I don't think he's going to be an especially good defender. And he's kind of played everywhere from catcher in high school to infield to outfield. Catcher is not an option for him as a pro, but somewhere he has played, he's just kind of played everywhere. But I think that despite the speed, I just don't think he has what it takes to be a center fielder long term. But I mean, I'm sure the Braves have evaluated that much closer than anything that I could, because they have a very good program for developing center fielders. So that's the thing. If you can't put him in center field, he's pretty much a left field only because of the arm. He definitely does not have the arm for right field, and he can maybe play in the infield defense, at least for the glove, but the arm just is not going to play. So I think he's pretty much a left field only, but the strides that he's made this year where he's really started to hit for more power. I mean, the on base has been there his whole career, even dating back to Charleston Southern, but the spike in power now that he is finally healthy and in the second year at a place, because I mean, he went from Charleston Southern to Kentucky and the power just didn't really translate to Kentucky. But second year this year, I mean, he almost tripled his home run total in the same number of games while keeping the on-base percentage high and actually improving the on-base percentage this year.
Another player that's been commonly mocked to the Braves, especially in over the last couple of months, is Mississippi State's ambidextrous pitcher, Durangelo Sanja. Matt, what's your overall perceptions? Is he someone that can, you know, stay pitching with both arms? Is he someone that you have a first round grade with? What are your overall thoughts on Durangelo?
Well, the switch pitching is what is going to draw the most attention from fans, but you're really not taking him for that because you're taking him as a right-handed pitcher. As a left-hander, he is more of a reliever and not an especially high-leverage reliever at that. I liked him out of high school just 2 years ago, and I feel pretty similar about him. Despite liking him, he wouldn't necessarily excite me in the first as much as he would in the second, which not going to happen. He's not that big. He's just 5'11", but he has enough athleticism to help cover up for some of that smaller stature risk that comes with being a sub-6-foot pitcher. The steps forward with the command this year really help out, and this was really only his second college season, so there could be more gains there. I mean, what he did this year, because his command last year was just awful. He pitched 50 innings, he walked 34, allowed 12 home runs, so he almost doubled his innings this year, 90.2 from 50, and he walked 4 guys less than he did all of last year, allowed 1 home run less than he did all of last year, while still keeping the strikeouts above 11. So, I mean, you're kind of hoping on that kind of command gain that you're able to see from him. But he's got a fastball up to 98 and a slider, which gives him a second legitimate pitch, as well as a changeup, which could be a third solid average pitch. The stuff is more good than electric, and he's just not that big. Plus, there were those command issues as a freshman. So that's just kind of why I like him, but don't really love him as a first-round pick.
And so there was another pitcher that you mentioned earlier, Braylon Doughty. Keith Law projected him to the Braves in the first round, presumably would be an underslot guy. What are your thoughts on him and, you know, the role as an underslot guy in the first round?
He's probably the most exciting player linked to the Braves right now publicly, but he's also got plenty of risk. He kind of came out of nowhere late in the summer last year, and then he didn't really pitch in the fall. So coming into the spring, there were really only some flashes, but just a ton of unknown. Then he had a great spring. He's got 3 pitches that can grade out as plus, including a 97-mile-an-hour fastball, a big-time curve, and a swing-and-miss slider. The pitches all have excellent life on them, and he throws strikes. He's only 6'1". He hasn't really been on the radar long, but this stuff is what you're just dreaming on with a kid like this. Obviously, a high character kid who's able to pick up stuff quickly. There's a lot to like, but there's plenty of unknown with someone like him too.
So I have a quick follow-up to Doughty and Sanja. You look at kind of the two guys recently the Braves drafted, Harrison Waldrop, Spencer Schwellenbach. You look at some of the guys in the system, Hayden Harris. You look at Riley Fry, even, who's doing well at high A. You know, these are all guys that are kind of undersized guys, and you really look at a flat vertical approach angle for these guys. Do you think that that may be something that the Braves are kind of targeting in these drafts with guys like Doughty and Sancho being, you know, undersized arms?
I do think – I don't think they're necessarily looking for undersized, but, yeah, I do think that they are looking for that vertical angle. I do think – it just happens to manifest more in those smaller guys. It is something that they clearly like, and they've had some success with it to some extent. Can't really say a ton because we haven't gotten to see these players really get far enough along yet to make that kind of call at this point. But There is something there that I do think is worth watching.
Well, Matt, we have taken enough of your time, but we got one more question for you. How when a draft is over and you're going through your evaluation, now I know it's tough to give a grade at the end of a day or at the end of 1 year, but when you go back and you're looking and you're evaluating a draft class itself, what are some metrics or like different benchmarks that you use to say, hey, this was a success? Hey, maybe they this draft class didn't hit. Like, what are you using to help evaluate?
Combination of two things, really. The amount of guys that make it to the big leagues and appear in a significant enough number of games, whether they make much impact or not, isn't so much a big factor in that, because just getting a guy to the big leagues and for more than just a cup of coffee is a win. And then you have guys that aren't going to make it to the big leagues that would still be in that win column if they end up getting traded for as a big piece in another deal, like Shea Langeliers, Vaughn Grissom, whatever they do. Those guys are absolute wins for the Braves, no matter what, at this point, just because they helped land the Braves two of their significant roster players. So those are really the two things that I look at when evaluating the long-term success of a class.
Here, what about you?
For me, I kind of want to be generous when you look at guys. Obviously we have hindsight. For me, it's just the quality of, if I'm looking at a class, I want to see at least one guy that's a major league starter, an impact player on the roster. And, at that point, if you can get one, even two guys out of a class, that's a successful class, in my opinion. There's very few classes that are going to have more than one or two guys. So really, even one quality major leaguer is what I would look for in a draft.
Excellent insight from a couple of brilliant baseball minds. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to join us, Matt. And thank you all to everyone that is listening. That is all we have for you this week. Can't wait to connect with you next week when we have Baseball America's very own Carlos Collazo here with us to also talk about the MLB draft. Thank you all for listening, and we will see you next week.